George Brocknadestad apparently has not arrived yet at this meeting, and therefore we will not be doing this section in your program on the Rosetta Tone. However, I also have for my presentation a brochure which you either have received or will be receiving very shortly. And the paper I am about to give will not be a responsive reading program on my brochure. It instead will discuss some of the issues that are raised in there and perhaps look at them one or two other ways. Paper I'm about to give was prepared for the Society of American Archivists. I have revised it some for this purpose, but it is important that that many people, even in the audio preservation field, may or may not come to their jobs with a technical background. So some of the things I say may seem redundant or obvious, but that's how we get from here to there, so that everybody travels the same train. Among the formidable tasks facing any archivist or curator is deciding what to preserve, what order to preserve it in, and what size chunk of that first batch can be preserved with the funds available or are being applied for. Incidentally, many of the points I make in here have been brought up by the previous speakers in the course of this afternoon's and in some cases this morning's activities. So it might serve also somewhat as a summation. Audio materials come to archives with the added complication of probable incomplete, imprecise, or unreliable identification on its container, on their containers. Unlike paper, looking at the object itself reveals little further of its content unless there is written data on the disc or tape reel, assuming that was the labeling which originally belonged there. In this best of all possible worlds, every item in each audio accumulation is completely annotated on the container. Each tape contains what its box says it does, and in that same order. Each disc has a label which accurately and completely identifies what is on the record, and the label has never fallen off and been attached to the wrong side or the wrong disc. All dates are accurate, as are all the spellings. All items which are part of a sequence are properly numbered within that sequence. Visual inspection discloses at what speed the carrier plays. We know beforehand how many tracks are on each tape as well as its playing time. The media will be in the same wonderful condition as the day it was recorded. Tape will be properly flat wound and have no splices. Discs will have no grunge on their surfaces. Everyone within the archive will agree on what should be preserved, in what order, and why the archive is saving the material anyhow. So much for fantasy. All audio media are deteriorating. Many of the more aged items are well past their designed-in survival time. And then there is the human element. Even if you are correct in assuming the data on the container applies to what is inside, it may lack enough detail to enable you to place the item in context without playing the darn thing, something which catalogers hate. Is this item complete in itself, or does it fit into a sequence of similar items? If the latter, where does it go? Spoken word collections can be particularly vexing if there is no established order. Long events such as conventions, legislative or court proceedings, or interviews can change meaning if the chronology is disturbed. The value of sound recordings to a researcher is greatly enhanced by identifying the sequence of the audio parts before he sits down to listen. A poorly identified audio item is intellectually opaque. No one can look at a roll of tape and hear it in the mind's ear as one hears the words from a printed page. A properly adjusted playback device is required. Tapes and discs usually have to be reproduced at near their original recording speed to be comprehensible. Evelyn Wood has not yet marketed a speed listening course, nor has the White Knight won for listening backward. But we now have entered a world where playback devices for the products of most once widely available recording technologies can no longer be purchased off the shelf. Looked for a tape recorder capable of playing back 10-inch reels at 1 7/8 inches per second lately? Even should the playback device be the proper one to reproduce your disc or tape, changes in the media itself, accumulated dirt in the grooves and the leached out byproducts of aging, and time and wear-induced alterations in the minute dimensions and tensions of an unrestored and unrecalibrated rated playback device may damage or destroy the carrier. Old splices come apart. Piecing together shards of tape requires skill and a whole lot of patience. The soft grooves of acetate discs can easily lose their high frequencies, if not exhibit more crippling damage when reproduced with a misfitted and misweighted stylus. Unless your archive is properly equipped and maintained, you really shouldn't be playing these back at all. So who plays them back? An ape, audio preservation expert, should be able to handle your media so it has much less chance of being destroyed during restoration and preservation. Notice the difference between restoration and preservation, two separate steps. Though we have all made recordings at one time or another, there are many tricky aspects of audio playback of older carriers which require the considerable technical experience and skill that an ape brings to the job. Yet archivists are the ones with the specialized content knowledge and thus have a better shot at figuring out what is likely to be on tape than an outside technician. They are the ones who can more easily place the audio into its appropriate intellectual framework. They have access to the written documents, which will support the exploration of future researchers of these materials. Notice we're working toward the end user here. If the object of this exercise is to create a preservation transfer, which is easily accessible to and understood by the researcher, what strategies are available to reach this goal? The ape will have the content window open, perhaps for the first time since the recording was made. He will be hearing the materials that you have given him to restore and to copy. The archivist can help him identify what he is hearing, help place it in the context the archivist desires, supply him with a way of coordinating what he hears with already established events, give him transcripts and so forth, using or creating appropriate identifiers, dates, page numbers from transcripts, program books, etc. Give him the means to fit the audio content into its proper contextual position within the archive's overall holdings. In other words, a subject-sensitized ape can make a rough catalog while the window is open. I'd like to say something about the relationship between cataloging and archival longevity. Audio materials are best stored under environmentally appropriate circumstances. Once shelved, the less handling, the better. Every move involves a possibility of temperature shock, the most destructive non-catastrophic event which these media have to endure. The more specific and detailed the cataloging, the less each item will be called for, since it is no longer necessary for a researcher to hear a large group of items to fish out a desired portion. Such cataloging should include data not normally called for by the present professional cataloging rules, but which are essential to identifying the recording event. It is my strong belief that professional catalogers should spend appropriate time to determine each recording event's date or a reasonable approximation thereof. When all recordings are considered as documents, how much more useful is a dated newspaper than an undated one? The cost of better cataloging is repaid by the reduced handling generated by the fewer number of items a researcher has to play through to find what he seeks. The benefit to the archive is that the consequent reduction in the number of times valuable materials unnecessarily move in and out of their benign environment, that's the benefit. Preservation cataloging, which is what I call this, which supplies data to meet the end user's requirements as well as that administratively necessary, will generate considerable benefits, not only by protecting the materials, its primary function, but increasing staff and user efficiency. Well, how do you figure out what runs at what speed, what number of tracks, what condition everything is in, and how much it all costs? The practical solution is to have a survey made by an APE, either a staff member or a consultant. Sometimes this may take more than one visit, the first to get the lay of the land, an interval to assemble appropriate playback equipment, then a longer visit to perform the analysis. However, a productive cross-examination by telephone can usually generate enough data to keep this to one trip. The APE's analysis should focus on the problems and consequent costs of migration of sound from the older carrier to a new one. There are two types of engineering services available. First is that of the transfer house. What you send out is what you get back, only with an extended lifespan. This service concentrates on moving the sound from one carrier to another, not on its content. The second is performed by an engineer who also acts in your stead and who combines the attributes of the copying service with a content awareness. This latter is a custom service. The former is closer to a production line. Part of the consulting process is to determine a balance between the two based on the original materials, their content and condition, and how they have been documented in the past. It is quite helpful to your APE to help him towards understanding something of your institutional culture. This includes its history, its aims, how the finished product fits in with your overall program, preservation, teaching, and research, and who your organization's heroes and villains have been and now are. This is particularly true of spoken material collections. It also helps to give him the lowdown about the functioning of, and perhaps even introduce him to, those at the financial end of things within your institution. Certainly, if you anticipate submitting a grant proposal, he should be working with the development people. Should you be contemplating sending a project out for bids, then when the final specifications are listed, they should be drawn in such a way that all bidders are basing their proposals on performing the same steps on these originals. Further, minimum standards should be included for the studio. These would include keeping the air conditioning and heating system running 24 hours whenever any of your tapes may be in the pipeline and wherever. Another example, some studios claim they are recording full track mono when they are actually recording mono on parallel stereo tracks, the way the machine usually comes from the factory. The guard band between the two tracks results in a nearly 4 dB signal-to-noise ratio loss. An additional set of full-track heads is not only more expensive, but also requires either a separate dedicated full-track recorder or a lot of head switching and retweaking, adding to studio overhead. This is a place the bean counters will try to fudge. Nonetheless, engineers will kill to pick up a dB or two of lower system background noise. What is your objective? Beware of substantially lower bids. Equipment costs, the continual need to upgrade, the continual need to self-educate, I might add, and maintenance time don't allow too much leeway, so very low bidders may well be cutting essential corners or, in many cases, may not fully comprehend what the process really requires. The expression, best qualified bidder, really has meaning here. How do you know if the amount you are asking for will cover the cost of what you are told it will preserve? The initial consulting stage should result in an idea of what is required to fulfill your needs. Each group of discs and tapes will need to be identified and processed in a particular way, employing a group of operations, each of which requires a sequence of steps, each adding time and a materials factor to the time required to the process and to process an individual item, extending that then to a batch of similar items. Some steps can be performed simultaneously, some partially so, and some must follow preceding ones. Designing the most efficient probable sequence of studio production steps, which meets your preservation objectives, is where your APE can be most highly effective. From the curator's standpoint, much depends on the choice of the engineer who performs the task. We are all self-promoters in a tiny field and well known to one another. We all have high opinions of ourselves, slightly lower ones of our competitors. A list of credits and reviews is fine, but it is much more useful to know how well satisfied previous clients have been after the job has been completed. Check references. How good is the finished result with how good it could have been? Quality control. There are no academic courses for training audio preservation engineers. The concepts underlying the entire preservation process are an inversion of the mental attitude with which graduates of most recording programs are launched. Our goal is long-term preservation, not immediate exploitation. Our goal is to be able to play it back 20 or 30 years down the road, not to allow yourself to be steered toward the latest, quote, best technology, unquote, even when demonstrably superior, if it is not already well established in the market. I can think of few things more frustrating than perfectly preserved software and no hardware to hear it on. Your ape must be well acquainted with the technical and marketing history of each of the media on which he is working before he allows your precious artifact to come into physical contact with your or his equipment. Nor is there a place here for the engineer to introduce his own creative sonic imprint. Fidelity, now there's an old-fashioned word. So what can your consultant do for you? Well, first off, he should look at the materials, help divide them into work groups, and give you an idea of what each segment will cost to preserve. This can be based on the work being done by an outside studio, often his, or by setting up an in-house system and his furnishing aid toward the training of the personnel to administer and operate it. Here are some of the problems I've encountered along the way. In one collection, it was unclear if a musician's name on a tape box indicated if he was performing or was being interviewed. When played back to determine which, some turned out to be edited and unedited interviews, and some were performances with and without radio announcements spliced in. The private funder wanted both, but only those pertaining to a specific conductor, and wanted the interviews and music differentiated. They had all been recorded on acetate-based tape during the 1950s and very early 1960s. Many splices had dried out and had to be remade during this initial auditing process, just to get far enough into the program material to identify it. Fortunately, the University Recording Service had a working tape recorder, which we demagnetized and cleaned first, it really needed it, and a splicing block, and Radio Shack had some splicing tape, so I could at least reassemble as I went. A very large archive was having problems with its tape masters, unique items with no backup copies from the mid-late 70s to the early 80s, which were squealing during playback. We've been hearing a fair amount of this. It turned out there was muck generated by oxide shedding, which had been initiated by hydrolysis, which accumulated in the tape head gap and in the tape guides, changing their effective dimensions and causing enough friction so the tape vibrated like a violin string, the oral result of which was a clone of blackboard-generated chalk squeal. Some guides were so gooey, notice all these technical terms, some guides were so gooey from the accumulated debris that they stopped the tape from moving from reel to reel. There were no cleaning materials in the archive, so the junk from a bad reel was making even the good reels sing. The problem was traced to one brand and product number of tape, and those in their original boxes were targeted for attention, almost 10,000 reels of them. But there had been a flood in the old storage facility, and some tapes had been repackaged into generic boxes. It was necessary to test play many of these, particularly those within the recording dates into which the other bad reels had fallen, to see if they also squealed and should thus be added to the list of reels needing treatment and recopying. They were. Another large tape archive of spoken material had tapes recorded at the very slow logging speed of 1 7/8 inches per second onto mostly 10-inch reels. A normal 2,400-foot reel holds 4 hours of audio at this speed, 8 hours if recorded half-track on both sides of the tape. However, there were years when they had used half-mil ultra-thin tape, thus holding 12 hours per side. Many are recorded on each of the two tracks, making a total running time of 24 hours. 4 hours or 24 hours per reel. It was important to determine the running time of these tapes so a realistic timetable and budget could be drawn up, one which reflected beforehand the engineering time and the materials required to copy them at 7.5 inches per second full track. Another collection, a disc collection, contained much public relations material, including the same program both with and without beeps to indicate where strip films should be manually advanced. Strip films, remember those? Both as acetate disc originals and, though differently labeled, pressed 16-inch discs as well. It was only necessary to copy one. We used one with the beep since they did not overlap any of the narration or music, so it could still be mated with film or, if preferred, edited later for pure listening. We were thus able to eliminate perhaps 10 sides running about 12 minutes each from the restoration and preservation schedule. In the same collection, there is a long stream of convention tapes, some of which were numbered consecutively on the boxes and some of which were more murkily identified. When checking against the published proceedings, which were supplied me by the archivist, I found there were sessions out of order, scattered among the numbered tapes, part on one, part on a much later one, duplicate reels, partial duplication, so I needed to pick up one connective paragraph elsewhere in the mess, as well as two other shorter conventions and a prayer luncheon, which ran before and during the main event, with many of the same participants, but without any supporting printed text. I was able to isolate these and logic them together, but only after figuring out that they were different events. This function would have been considerably more difficult if it weren't for the accompanying printed matter. Finally, a number of years ago, I was asked by a major symphony orchestra, not represented here, to take a small core of old radio broadcasts and expand it to create as complete an archive as possible of commercial, broadcast, and non-broadcast, but licitly and illicitly recorded musical events, many of them done in the house with a Ewer-type portable recorder. For the older materials, which had been heard nationwide, I found instantaneously recorded discs in archives and private collections throughout the country and Canada as well. By investigating the broadcast distribution system, the quality of the telephone lines which brought the program to a given city where there were artifacts, and whether it was taken directly off the incoming transmission line or was sonically compromised by having been broadcast, I was able to figure out which of multiple surviving copies was most likely to be of the highest fidelity and arranged to limit comparisons to these before choosing the one to use as the source original. To deal with the many program fragments, particularly from the early years and the in-house recordings, the starting point of the process was to compile a complete broadcast history and discography of the orchestra, including the content of each program, and index it by selection and performer. So many hitherto untraced events were uncovered that the orchestra's formal history will look a bit different the next time they publish one of those big anniversary scholarly tomes. So, it is not only the engineer whose academic training does not properly prepare him to deal with audio preservation. Considering how much of our historical and cultural heritage is in non-paper formats, it astonishes me that there is no academic program anywhere in the U.S. to prepare archival generalists to understand the nature of this aspect of what they will be curating. Though I do understand there is an occasional course given along these lines at Syracuse University, I feel it should be part of the training programs of all librarians and archivists. Most will never perform the actual studio work during their professional lifetimes, but they will be often administering such projects with little exposure beforehand as to how these materials function and age, and thus be at the mercy of their preservation fulfillment person. When considering entering upon such a project, be sure to leave time and budget for on-site discussion with the consultant, your APE, concerning the various available preservation strategies and how they apply to your archival audio materials. Take advantage of this time to resolve any questions you may have about the processes involved. Don't be afraid to appear uninformed. We all know a lot about a few things and less about others. Consider the consultant's visit as an opportunity to expand your knowledge base. The person you have hired is there to help, not dictate. After all, what he does impacts your career. Protect it. Ask questions. Thank you. And we can now go on to asking questions.